Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. No, Eskimos do not have 50 different words for snow. They don't even have 20 different words for snow. You do know that, don't you? Linguists debunked this urban legend long ago. Scientist Steven Pinker, in fact, refers to it in his book, The Language Instinct. The notion is obviously appealing to us, though, because, well, it stands to reason that people who live with so much snow would have different ways of referring to it. But so do we. We might say dusting, powder, heavy flakes, wet snow, flurries, or any number of other more poetic things. But it's all snow. Not so surprising, then, to discover that there are also different terms for different types of ice, especially when you're a scientist studying it. It's all ice, but it might be glacial ice, sea ice, or ice sheets. And that's important to know, because the way this ice behaves tells us a lot about our climate, now and in the future. Today's Soundprint is part of our series called Pole to Pole, produced with support from the National Science Foundation. It takes us from the massive island of Greenland to the Andean peaks of Peru. Produced by Dan Grossman, this is Meltdown.
Ilulissat, Greenland, on this warm spring day, looks like other Inuit towns I visited. The prefab houses are painted in pastel hues, and sled dogs lounge in the yards. But this village of native hunters has a distinction. It has front row seats for watching the drama of global warming unfold. Ilulissat is located at the mouth of a 30-mile-long fjord that begins at Jakobshavn Isbre, the world's fastest-moving glacier, probably the birthplace of the iceberg that sunk the Titanic. I'm here to learn about the Greenland ice sheet, and I've chartered a boat to see bergs break off into the ocean. For most of the 1990s, Jakobshavn, one of the few places where Greenland's ice sheet hits the sea, an outlet glacier, flowed at about 2 feet an hour. Though no faster than a garden snail, that's exceptionally fast for a glacier. Then, just before the year 2000, scientists were shocked when it suddenly doubled its speed. Jakobshavn now spews out icebergs the size of a city block at a phenomenal rate, about 50 billion tons of bergs a year. It's too dangerous to go to Jakobshavn itself, so we've steamed to another outlet glacier 6 hours north. It looks like a frothy river rapids frozen in place, squeezed between low hills of gray stone. The seemingly motionless stream is made of thousands of bluish blocks of fractured ice. It fans out where it hits the sea, forming a sheer cliff many stories high. Every few minutes, a hunk the size of a truck or even a house peels off the face in clouds of spray and pulverized ice. This is calving. Until the late 1990s, scientists did not expect global warming to have much impact on the Greenland ice sheet. Then Jakobshavn and two other big outlet glaciers started calving at unprecedented rates. In 2007, the ice sheet lost about twice as much ice as all the ice in the Alps. Some researchers say it's possible the ice sheet could shed mass even faster. They point to new evidence that the entire perimeter of the massive ice sheet is beginning to accelerate seaward. There's plenty of sound and fury here on the coast where the glaciers calve, but to understand what it's signifying, many researchers travel miles inland on top of the ice sheet. I'm hitching a helicopter ride to a research site where I'll join some of them. I've borrowed a duffel bag of heavy polar clothing because though it's spring-like here on the coast, where I'm going, it's far below freezing. 2 days later, it's morning, and I'm camped out at Swiss Camp, a research base 50 miles inland. It's run by Professor Conrad Steffen of the University of Colorado. There's nearly a mile of ice below me. There's also a tower with weather sensors and half a dozen pale pink and yellow canvas tents for sleeping. Stefan first came here in 1990 to study Greenland's weather.
I have a network now of 20 automatic weather stations sitting on the ice sheet. They are all measuring about 30 parameters and transmit the data via satellite every hour back to Boulder, to our university.
Stefan analyzes the data where it's warm and comfortable, though here, where he comes for a few weeks each year, it's nearly 0 degrees Fahrenheit and snowing. But Stefan says it's not as cold here as it used to be. In the first several years he recorded, temperatures went down. He now knows this was the impact of Mount Pinatubo, the volcano in the Philippines that erupted cataclysmically in 1991, ejecting millions of tons of material into the atmosphere and cooling the entire planet.
Then it started to get warmer in 1995. Suddenly we had a huge melt here, and these melties occurred more frequently. In about 1998, I realized that the circumstances are not the same. It's getting really warmer at this location.
Earth has warmed an average of about 1 degree Fahrenheit since the mid-1970s. The Arctic is warming much faster. The winter temperature here has gone up about 7 degrees since 1991. 2006 was the warmest year so far.
We should have temperatures around minus 20, minus 30, minus 40 degrees here. It was melting. In the middle of the winter, we had several events. The thermometer was above the freezing point, and we can see that in the snow because we have ice layers. This has not happened in 16 years.
Many researchers are trying to figure out what's happening to the ice sheet. One of them, Jose Rial, a seismologist, an earthquake sleuth from the University of North Carolina, has joined Stefan at Swiss Camp.
We don't do these things because they are easy. We do them because they are hard.
Despite the fact that Rial grew up in the tropics of Venezuela, he seems at home dashing through the snow so near the North Pole. His head of wild white hair and a bulky red parka give him a look vaguely reminiscent of St. Nick.
Hi-yo!
The seismologist began his career listening for the signs of covert Soviet nuclear explosions. Now he's using essentially the same equipment, super-sensitive vibration sensors, to detect movement below and around Swiss Camp. Today he's off to collect computer memory chips with data from a network of 10 detectors he's deployed in a ring 7 miles across.
Are you ready?
Yes, I am ready.
I meet Rial the next day, rested and warmed with coffee from the camp's overworked espresso pot. He's viewing the first weeks of data on a laptop.
Oh, man, this is going to be a bonanza.
Oh, you found another.
Look at this. Events everywhere.
The computer screen displays rows of wiggly lines showing how the ice jiggled in several places. Nobody has ever put such seismic stations on the ice sheet before, so he's unsure what to expect. He does hope to detect ice blocks at Jakobshavn Ispre miles away, scraping the bedrock as they march seaward or actually snap off into the ocean. If he's captured such an event, he says it should show up as identical signals arriving 20 seconds apart at two of his stations.
Yes. Awesome. Look at that. This is about, oh, sh**. 20 seconds. Oh.
Conrad Stefan and other researchers in the cramped tent crowd around to witness Rial's discovery.
Oh my God, this is check us out. I don't know what I have with all those clicks in there. That's a problem.
Rial can't tell yet what these results mean. They're too fresh. But when I call him some months later to learn more, he says he's since discovered powerful 20 to 40 minute rumbles, possibly caused by tremendous pieces of the ice sheet lurching across its bedrock foundation. Evidence that the ice sheet is changing not only at the surface, but also deep below. Rial's findings add weight to research by NASA scientist Jay Zwali, who's been visiting the ice sheet for 35 years.
Thinning at the margins that we've measured in the 1990s
is an indication that the ice sheet is responding to climate change. Now we're also seeing that some of the glaciers are accelerating, as detected by ice quakes, and we're seeing the melt acceleration here.
I've joined Zwali and Stefan in a ski-equipped prop airplane. By air, it's just a short hop from Swiss Camp to the site of a new weather station. From the sky, I see the snow-covered ice sheet is not the featureless plain it seems to be from the ground. It undulates gently, subtly echoing the hills and valleys of its rocky base. In places, it has jagged cracks and frozen rivers and lakes. I'm told that last winter's snow cover will soon melt and the surface will be slick layer ice, crisscrossed by fast-flowing meltwater streams and rivers. The researchers haul out toolboxes, shovels, electronics, and hardware.
Now we're going to hop out in a minute. Yeah, the toolbox.
The team assembles the station from pipes and cables and nuts and bolts. It looks like an artificial Christmas tree laid out flat on the snow, with a round antenna at the top and shiny bows.
Where do you want to go with it?
We can start over.
They drill a hole in the surface with an ice fisherman's auger. Together, they hoist the contraption upright like the flag-raising soldiers at Iwo Jima and drop the bottom end into the hole.
Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Hanging down like silvery ornaments are an odd assortment of instruments that measure sunlight, temperature, wind speed and direction, as well as snowfall. There's also a global positioning system, or GPS device. That's Jay Zwali's experiment. Zwali installed his first GPS device at Swiss Camp in 1995. He was curious to know if the ice moved uniformly or changed over the course of the year.
And after we got 1 year's data back, we discovered that the first year there was almost no change.
There, 50 miles from the coast, the ice crept seaward a foot a day without variation, as researchers thought it should. Nothing interesting there. So Zwali stopped paying attention. But his device kept collecting data. And in 1999, the scientists took another look.
We found that there was a significant speed up. And now we have measurements that show that the speed doubles in the summertime.
From 1 foot a day to 2 feet a day. It doesn't sound like much, but a doubling in speed is big news. It's sort of as if the sun suddenly sped up in the sky. Zwali says the acceleration must mean that the ice sheet is getting unstuck from its bedrock and sliding seaward.
These are new things that are starting to kick in the ice sheet that will most likely make the loss is larger in the future.
Okay, running.
With help from graduate student Kevin Sampson back at Swiss Camp, Stefan is setting up a snowmobile-mounted radar device. He'll use it to peer into the ice sheet to discover how warmth on top could influence the bottom.
You want to follow?
Yeah, how far are you going to go?
Oh, just across the base.
Stefan thinks water from melting snow is the key to explaining the changes on the perimeter of the ice sheet. In summertime, snow on the surface of the ice sheet's rim thaws, producing torrents of water. Could this meltwater trickle through a mile of solid ice to the bottom? Stefan says yes, because the ice isn't actually solid. It's riddled with cracks, like the ones I saw from the air.
And the water can percolate through these ice cracks and actually reach the base of the ice sheet. It's like you put the small cushion underneath, and then it starts to move faster.
Many glaciologists agree that summer meltwater is unsticking the base of the ice sheet's perimeter from its foundation, causing it to sprint seaward. They say the sliding is in part responsible for the massive changes at the Jakobshavn Outlet Glacier. Surveys by air and satellite show that the ice sheet is getting thinner every year.
And that shows me that we are increasing the area in Greenland where you melt, where you have meltwater ponding.
And more melting caused by future warming could make even larger areas take off.
What does it mean? It's only a glacier. But if you start to have these outlet glaciers to advance that fast, they can actually draw out mass from further back. And you have to remember that we have 3,000 meters of ice in the center of Greenland.
Much of Greenland's ice sheet disappeared 130,000 years ago when Earth was only a few degrees warmer than today. If warming continues unchecked, Earth could reach that same temperature later this century. The collapse of the ice sheets would lag behind by many decades, if not centuries, but the result would be a catastrophic rise in sea level, inundating some of the world's largest cities. It's not just massive ice sheets like Greenland's that are melting. Chunks much smaller, such as mountaintop glaciers, are in danger as well. And scientists patrol these glaciers with just as much concern. Scientist Lonnie Thompson hikes up a steep mountain-lined valley 40 miles outside of Cusco, Peru, in South America. He sometimes doubles over, gasping for breath. His asthma is sometimes exacerbated by extreme altitude, but he's made more than 50 mountain expeditions on five continents.
I have this vision of nighttime crossing one of the passes out here about a day's journey away, just totally sick and puking between the ears of this horse.
Thompson is a glaciologist at Ohio State University and one of America's most celebrated and decorated scientists. 30 years ago, when he began his career, he was an outsider. He wanted to use ice cores from tropical mountains to study climate at a time when other climate researchers were focusing on polar ice.
You know, people don't normally think about tropics and ice. They don't go together. But here on these high mountaintops, they're a very distinct recorder of the history in this part of the world.
Over the years, Thompson begged and borrowed to pay for his work and eventually proved the value of tropical ice research. Recently, he received the coveted Presidential Medal of Science. Today, shielded from above by a floppy, wide-brimmed hat and supported from below by a steel-tipped walking stick, Lonnie Thompson is following the footsteps of an 18th-century cleric. He's on the trail of a so-called miracle that created the opportunity for bona fide scientific research.
In las estancias de Okungante, vivía un indígena.
In the ranch lands of Okungante, there lived an indigenous man named Maita. His ranch was located in the lowland valleys of Sinacara, at the foot of the majestic snow-capped peak of Kokepunku.
The legendary incident occurred on June 12, 1783, right here in Peru's Sinacara Valley. As told in this version of the story, a church inquisitor was investigating a report by a shepherd of possible sacrilege by a mysterious young visitor.
Anxious to catch him, Dr. Landa reached out and to his great surprise caught a hold of a little tayanka shrub that grew from the rock.
When the clergyman apprehended the youth under a headwall of craggy glaciated mountains, he was dazzled with light. Suddenly, where the boy had been, Christ appeared in agony.
He seemed to cry out to the heavens, my God, why have you forsaken me? Confused and stupefied, the men all fell to their knees and remained there in an ecstasy of faith.
Fast forward about 150 years. The location of the vision has become a holy site, attended each June by crowds of pilgrims. In the mid-1930s, celebrated Peruvian photographer Martin Chombi made the arduous trek himself, lugging his heavy wooden camera.
He was up there. I think he was up on this slope here, looking down on the glacier because you can see it.
On this day, about 75 years later, glaciologist Lonnie Thompson is huffing and puffing up this worn path. He bears no offerings, but he does carry reproductions of photos Chombi snapped here.
We want to look and see how much ice has been lost since the 1930s by repeating photographs in about the same place.
The snow-wrapped mountains captured by Chombi appear in living color as the scientist rounds a bend, searching for the exact vantage point from which the original photos were taken.
You can see the change up there, for sure.
Of course, he hasn't yet been able to superimpose the Chombi shot on a photo from the present, but even eyeballing it, Thompson can see already that these glaciers are suffering.
Particularly the one square in front of us. And that has lowered 100, 150 meters from where it was in the mid-30s. And then there's a number of glaciers here that have completely disappeared.
These wasted ice fields are a few data points, puzzle pieces in the jigsaw of what's happening to the world's small glaciers, about 100,000 of them. Around the world, they're melting. One recent global survey of 27 glaciers in 9 mountain ranges found that mountain ice lost a stunning average of 30 feet in thickness between 1980 and 2005. Some scientists predict a loss of up to one-third of the volume of the world's small glaciers by century's end, making them the leading cause of rising sea levels for the coming decades. Thompson wants precise figures. How fast are such glaciers melting, and what happens when they're gone? He'll move mountains, or at least climb them, to find out. I've joined Thompson on another trip, a day's drive from the site of the pilgrimage. Our destination is the Khalkhaya Ice Cap, the first tropical glacier Thompson studied 33 years ago. He's returned 27 times since. We're a team of 19, including 6 researchers, a cook, and native guides. Our packs and cases are lashed to a dozen horses and donkeys. We labor up a boulder-strewn ridge, and there, beyond more ridges and valleys, is what looks like a huge, brilliant white bank of snow, the Khalkhaya Ice Cap. It's the world's largest tropical glacier. Thompson first came here to drill a core of ice at the summit, 18,500 feet above sea level.
It's like a book. If you imagine a tree ring, there's a dust layer here every year. That record goes back over 1,500 years. So it's a very long, well-kept record of the history of climate and environment in this part of the world.
Thompson's team makes a base camp at the edge of the ice cap, where sharp shards of chocolate brown stone give way to Khalkhaya's glittering dome. The distant valleys and ridges are dry and barren, but here there's water everywhere. It dribbles off the ice cap's edges, creating sparkling icicles. One day, the researchers hike around the perimeter of the ice cap to a vantage point for viewing Khalkhaya's largest outlet glacier. It's a tongue of fractured ice hundreds of feet long that spills down from near the summit like a frozen waterfall.
Well, since the first aerial photograph was taken here, this whole ice cap has shrunk about 30%.
Looks like a lot of ice to me.
A lot of ice, and a lot less ice than when we first came here.
Thompson's been snapping photos of this outlet glacier from the exact same spot with a precision camera nearly every year for almost 3 decades. With these images, he monitors its health as carefully as a pediatrician tracks a newborn's weight.
If you look in the valley, you can see it took 150 years for it to retreat up to where the edge of the lake is, and that's where the ice was in 1978. Photo from last year had the ice coming down into the lake all the way across. And this year, we can see a huge amount of bedrock exposed on the right side of the glacier.
Is this more than you expected?
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, we see incremental changes every year, but this is much larger than what we saw last year or the previous year.
Thompson predicts the ice tongue will retreat right up the cliff and will surely be gone within a decade. He says Khalkhaya is now smaller than it's been in about 5,000 years.
Yeah, it's kind of sad to see something you've worked on most of your life disappearing in before your eyes. And I think there's a real possibility, depending on my health, that I might actually see the place up on the summit where the drill hit bedrock back in 1983.
So the canary in the mine turned out to be on top of a mountain?
Well, I think these tropical glaciers are canaries because what they tell us is that for an area known for its continuity of temperatures, that temperatures are rising. What's happening here on Khalkhaya is happening on Kilimanjaro in Africa, on Mount Kenya, throughout the Himalayas. So it's something that we should take heed of.
Thompson believes there is at least one good thing that can come from his life's work here, to convince the world that global warming is real and deadly serious, not a hoax or a half-baked theory.
Khalkhaya has no political agenda. It is summing up what's happening to its environment, and it's retreating. To me, it's some of the clearest evidence that we can present to politicians, our policymakers, that the world is changing and that we should be concerned about it.
Alpaca herders of Peru's high Andes are taking heed. Many of them graze their flocks at least part of the year in glacier-fed wetlands. Some such marshes are drying up, stressing livestock, and causing disputes over water rights and land use. Thompson is speaking to a gathering of shepherds and village representatives about global warming and its impacts in Sequani, the largest town near Quelccaya. A woman in the audience says that poor people in less developed countries like Peru are taking the brunt of the problem. What can we do, she asks.
When I look at this issue, you're absolutely right. The most impacted are, in my opinion, the ones who have least contributed to the problem and yet have the least resources to actually deal with the changes that come along.
While the people here can do little to slow global warming, Thompson says they must find ways to cope with the loss of the glaciers.
I mean, the glaciers store water. They release it in the dry season.
And Western Peru has virtually no rain for 6 months a year. Everybody there needs water when it's dry. Herders, farmers, as well as city dwellers. Dams may be one way to compensate for the loss of glacial meltwater. The problem is, Peru can't afford a public works project of that magnitude. Thompson and his colleagues keep coming up with more evidence that the world's small glaciers are under siege.
We are seeing, I believe, an acceleration in the rate that ice is being lost in the tropics. And I think in many of these places, we've actually passed the threshold of viability for these ice fields. They are remnants of another climate, and they will continue to disintegrate and ultimately disappear in today's climate.
And the problem is, we don't even know what today's climate is. One thing that is certain is that the Earth is getting warmer, and that's bad news for the world's ice.
Meltdown was produced by Dan Grossman. It airs as part of the special series Pole to Pole, produced with support from the National Science Foundation as part of the International Polar Year. This program was originally edited by George Hicks and Anna Benstead, who produced it for WBUR's documentary series Inside Out. Additional support for Meltdown came from the National Geographic Society and the Whole Systems Foundation. Pole to Pole is an international documentary and multimedia collaboration, and you can find more programs on our website, soundprint.org. Next week on Soundprint, our Pole to Pole series continues as we study climate, geology, and life in some of the most distant and forbidding places on the planet. You'll hear tales of heroic travelers and explorers of the past and in-depth scientific research on the future of the planet. Don't miss our coverage of the International Polar Year coming this month and next on Soundprint. You can own your favorite Soundprint episodes on CD. Give us a call at 1-888-38-TAPES and we'll send it right out. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. Let us know what you thought about today's show. Your comments help keep us on track. The best way to get in touch is by email. The address is talkback@soundprint.org, and be sure to mention your local station. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.